This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and now politics. This week, President Obama took a new stab at the Arab Spring and the Mideast peace process. Republican presidential hopeful Newt Gingrich ran into serious difficulties, and a gang of six is down to five. Joining us now to talk about all that are our regular Friday observers, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of The New York Times. Good to see you both.
Good to be with you.
And first, let's start with what President Obama said about Israel and the Palestinians. David, what did you make of all this?
Well, I was in Europe when the speech came, and the press reaction there and the expert reaction was ecstatic. Finally, a president was spanking Israel, declaring Israel was the primary barrier to peace. Sort of the flip side of the Republican reaction, actually.
Not that he actually said that.
Right, but that was their interpretation of the speech. I do think that's a bit of an overread. I think he was more balanced than that. Nonetheless, I do think it's a little obtuse to talk abstractly about the 1967 borders and ignore the specific realities of what's just happened. I mean, Israel did withdraw from Gaza and the result and upset some settlements, and the result was not more peace, it was more war. A similar thing happened in the north of Israel and Lebanon. And so the Israeli public is in a certain position right now, skeptical. It's also at a moment in time when Hamas and the PA have formed an alliance. It's also at a position in time when the Arab Spring is really the central issue in the region, not the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, which really has no prospect of being solved anytime soon. So I guess I don't really mind what Obama said. I'm not sure why he picked a fight with Israel at this moment.
EJ, what'd you make of that?
Well, I was astonished that people saw him as picking a fight with Israel. I mean, there were two central issues on which he took Israel's side. He said that Israel has legitimate questions about the inclusion of Hamas in the government of the Palestinian Authority. And he also backed Israel's position in the coming fight in September over a Palestinian state. So there was a lot in there for Israel. And when it came to his statement about 1967 lines, he was just repeating. He was a president, so unlike other officials, Hillary Clinton back in November of 2009 said the U.S. supported the Palestinian goal of an independent and viable state based on 1967 lines with agreed swaps. So I think the question is, why is Prime Minister Netanyahu picking this fight? Jeff Goldberg, writing in The Atlantic, said of Netanyahu, he seems to go out of his way to alienate the president. Why does he do this? My suspicion is that it's Israeli internal politics, but it's sure not helpful to the peace process.
So the fatal illusion of American policy for Republican and Democratic presidents is that if we somehow got a magic line on the map that we could solve this thing. This is not about territory. It's about moral systems. It's about narrative. It's about something much deeper. And so he, again, falls for the illusion that so many presidents have fallen for, that we just need the right map.
Although I don't think this speech was mainly about a map. In fact, he talked about a lot of those other things in the speech, and a lot of people have just plucked this one line out and made it the centerpiece.
You also talked a great deal about the Arab Spring, as it's called. And in the past this year, David Brooks, you've noted that the president sometimes has been out in front on the Arab Revolution, sometimes behind the curve. Here is what he said yesterday about Syria.
The Syrian people have shown their courage in demanding a transition to democracy. President Assad now has a choice. He can lead that transition or get out of the way.
It's the policy of the times they are changing.
Yeah, no, I thought this was an excellent part of the speech. You know, this was a guy who talked about engaging some of the more dictatorial regimes a couple years ago, but he's recognized what's happened, and he's adapted his policy to the Arab Spring, to what's happened. And I think in this speech he did a very nice job of putting American values out front there and saying who we're for, especially in terms of Syria and Libya and other countries. And I think he put the U.S. in a very good position where we can't always affect things the way we want, but this is what we believe in. We'll do what we can.
Let's go on to some Washington news. Newt Gingrich is running for president in 2012. Here's a man, EJ, who is long familiar with national media, national politics. He's had over a decade to think about running for president. And in a week, he seems to have run out of toes to stub on various issues in the Republican field. What's going on?
At this point, it might be more relevant to talk about the impact of the end of the world on the 2012 election than to talk about Newt's possibility of becoming president. You know what I think is most unfortunate about this whole thing is I think he meant exactly what he said on Meet the Press.
He said the Paul Ryan plan, he was against
it. Is a form of social engineering, and the American people won't buy it. Why did Newt Gingrich say this? Because he got totally burned by Bill Clinton back in the 1995-96 budget fight over Medicare. He knows how sensitive this issue is. No Republican has actually come out and fully embraced the Ryan plan. I guess former Governor Huntsman said he'd vote for it, but I don't expect any Republican to run on this. But it's become, as the Democrats are saying, a litmus test for Republicans. So now Newt is even denied saying what he said. It's a very strange position he put himself in.
David Brooks, did Newt Gingrich reveal his profound weaknesses as a candidate here?
Yeah. I mean, he's a fatal weakness for hyperbole, a fatal inability to control his ideas, a complete absence of management style. I think I said on this program I wouldn't trust the guy to manage the 7-Eleven. And, you know, so he has these world historical ideas about 7 or 8 a minute, and they're interesting to listen to, but as a presidential candidate, he's hopeless. But EJ's point is a good one, though. This is actually a real debate in the Republican Party. A lot of people saying that politically it's insane to do what Ryan's doing. I happen to think it's semi-insane, but also semi-necessary. But Gingrich didn't come out of nowhere. There's a large talk radio segment saying we should never cut Medicare, we should never cut Medicare. And he was really speaking for that, and it's got to be heard in the Republican Party.
I want to ask you also, EJ, about the Gang of Six. Six senators, 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats, have been sort of behind the scenes, discreet hope of the deficit-cutting camp. They've been adapting ideas from the Bowles-Simpson Commission and elsewhere, it seemed, into some kind of bipartisan plan. Now, Senator Tom Coburn, the conservative Republican from Oklahoma, says count him out, at least for now. What's going on?
Well, I think it's always been an illusion that if you had all the goodwill in the world in the current climate, you could settle this problem. And I think Coburn's withdrawal shows that. You have a fundamental divide, and that Republicans are very wary of putting revenue on the table. Yes, the Republicans involved in the Gang of Six have talked about tax reform, but it's not clear how much they're willing to put on the table in new taxes. And if you're not willing to do that, the kind of cuts you have to make to balance the budget are so deep that no Democrats can buy them. Perhaps if this special election on Tuesday in upstate New York, where the Democrat has made a big deal of the Ryan budget, if she wins the Democrat a surprise victory, maybe it would shake the debate a little. But I think Coburn was just reflecting a reality.
You know, we have to raise taxes, we have to cut Medicare, at least tax revenues, and the Gang of Six was the best way to do that. Now it's hopeless. There's a possibility we'll have a complete meltdown with the debt ceiling this summer.
Well, thanks for also for disabusing us of illusions left and right here in the past several minutes. David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post.
Thank you.
This is NPR.
We are getting some financial advice next. We're seeking it after spending this week hearing young people in our series Money Counts. One of them was Brandon Smith. He's a recently graduated journalism major with $98,000 in student loans. The people who heard his story include Beth Kobliner, who writes about personal finance.
For many students, there's a very practical thing that they should know. There's something called income-based repayment plans. So basically, it allows you to pay back your student loans as a percentage of income. And after 20 years, if you're going into a relatively low-income job, your loans disappear completely. But in general, I think we're realizing that we have to start paying more attention to what college a student goes to, what they're interested in studying, and how much debt they're going to take on to get that degree.
We've also talked this week about financial literacy programs. Suppose that I'm a young person and I actually got a job and I just don't have time to go to someone's program.
Right.
I didn't get anything in school. How should I go about learning about finances and making sure I'm getting decent advice rather than hokum?
Right. Well, you can fall into a few different camps. You can be in information overload and you say, there is so much out there. I have no idea where to turn, so I'm just going to ignore it all. Then you have people who are very techie and people who get really involved in websites and learning all about the different options that they have. But I think there's a little bit of a belief that the technology is going to make it all better. And I've heard one economist say, we wouldn't have had this major financial crisis if people were keeping up with the products. And I think that's a myth. And I think it's the worst advice, and we should be doing the opposite. I think we have to go back to basics. We have to go look at the very old-fashioned notions of, you shouldn't spend more money than you have.
Rather than I need to learn about derivatives in order to invest
in them. Exactly. I think that's really the wrong track to go on. It goes back to some very basic fundamentals of explaining to people, first of all, where are you getting this information from? Is it being sponsored by a bank? Is the website that's offering it to you, are they getting money back from what you're clicking on? You know, being aware of that, but probably even more important, getting back to the real basics. Shop around for a good deal. Shop around for a low interest rate. You don't have to be able to know how to compute how much interest you'll pay down the road. You just have to know that, I want to pay 5% rather than 10%.
We've been talking about young people this week, but of course there is the matter of retirement. Mm. When is a good age to start planning and socking money away for retirement?
21. And
I guess I'm a little late, but go ahead.
I think that sounds frightening to some, but I've always explained how the retirement accounts like IRAs, individual retirement accounts, and 401k plans, those are called retirement accounts, but they're also super smart savings accounts because they offer tax breaks that are terrific and allow your money to grow very, very quickly because you're not paying tax on the interest year after year after year. So as soon as you have even a little bit of money, I'm a real advocate in putting money into something called a Roth IRA. And if you need it, the money you put in an emergency, you can get it out. But basically starting as early as possible.
Beth Kobliner is the author of Get a Financial Life. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Keeping to his extraordinary pace of making a film a year, Woody Allen returns with a new comedy called Midnight in Paris, which arrives in the U.S. after premiering at this year's Cannes Film Festival. The movie stars Owen Wilson as a screenwriter visiting Paris who magically travels back in time to meet his artistic heroes of the 1920s. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Woody Allen isn't religious, but he has a rabbinical side. And over the last decade, his films have become more and more like Talmudic parables for atheists. On the surface, these movies are streamlined, even breezy, and they often have voiceover narration to get the pesky exposition out of the way fast. Philosophically, Allen has settled on resignation, a cosmic shrug. There's no God, no justice, people are inconstant, life is meaningless, so where do you want to eat? I have a problem, though, buying into the worldview of someone whose world is a closed ecosystem. There's no evidence that Allen lets any contemporary culture penetrate his hard defensive shell. Music stopped in the 40s, if not earlier. Ditto literature, ditto film, with a pass for select European directors. He seems locked in a daydream of the past. The good news is that Allen has made the lure of nostalgia the theme of his supernatural comedy Midnight in Paris, which might be why this is his best, most emotionally pure film in over a decade. It's a romantic fantasy that's also a sly act of self-criticism. The time-traveling hero, Gil, played by Owen Wilson, is a successful Hollywood screenwriter on holiday in Paris with his brisk, upwardly mobile fiancée, Inez, played by Rachel McAdams. Gil considers himself a hack and, to Inez's horror, wants to write novels instead of movies. How he wishes he could be a writer in Paris. Better yet, Paris in the 20s, alongside Scott and Zelda, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, and all those other giants living high yet creating enduring works of art. It would certainly be preferable to being a tourist in Paris with Inez and her old professor, Paul.
I hope you're not going to be as antisocial tomorrow at Versailles.
How was I antisocial?
Oh, please. I mean, you could totally tell you didn't want to go.
Well, I mean, they're your friends, and I have to admit, I'm not quite as taken with him as you are.
He's brilliant. You know, I had such a crush on him in college, and Carol's very bright.
I mean, he's a pseudo-intellectual, just a little bit.
Gil, I hardly think he'd be lecturing at the Sorbonne if he's a pseudo-intellectual.
You can almost hear the familiar Woody Allen cadences. Yet Owen Wilson isn't the usual East Coast intellectual Allen hero, and he makes the lines his own. Apart from Mia Farrow's in The Purple Rose of Cairo, this is the finest lead performance in an Allen film that wasn't by Allen, and finer than many of Allen's, too. You sense the vein of wistfulness under his stoner cool, the longing for definition behind his spaciness. It's a thrilling moment when he sits forlornly on some steps in the rain at midnight. A vintage automobile rumbles by. The champagne-swilling occupants invite him in, and he's suddenly back in the 20s. How? No explanation. Allen just breezes past all that the way he did in Purple Rose, and before that in his great 70s short story, The Kugelmass Episode, happily eliminating the sci-fi wheels and pulleys that tend to suck up so much screen time. Gill is just there, counseling Scott about Zelda, drinking with Hemingway, showing parts of his novel to Gertrude Stein, and falling in love with a woman named Adriana, played by a stunningly beautiful Marion Cotillard. Adriana bonds with Gill over his love of the past, except the past she loves is the 1890s, and not her vulgar present. His 20s ideal woman hates the 20s, a bitter irony. Allen doesn't do anything particularly interesting with Scott and Zelda. My guess is he's too in awe of them. But as Hemingway, played with forthright manly manliness by Corey Stoll, is a riot, and as Gertrude Stein, Kathy Bates proves that in an absurd context, playing it straight can make you funnier than a thousand clowns. Midnight in Paris is a doodle, but it's easy and graceful, and its ambivalent view of nostalgia has all kinds of resonance. As I watched, I felt a different sort of nostalgia, not for the Parisian 20s, but the days in which Allen regularly turned out freewheeling, pitch-perfect tall tales in print and on screen. The movie is so good, it takes you back to those days, which were the days, my friend.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's been nearly 4 years since NASA's Dawn spacecraft set out from Earth on a journey past the orbit of Mars to the asteroid belt and its target Vesta, a chunk of rock the size of Arizona. Earlier this month, after traveling over 1 billion miles through space, the spacecraft spotted the asteroid, snapped a fuzzy little picture, and sent it back to Earth. It's now cruising closer at a leisurely speed of 670 miles per hour, preparing to slip into orbit around the asteroid in July, if everything goes according to plan. But what is it going to tell us about the asteroid, and what's it going to do when it gets there? Why visit an asteroid? Why not some other target like a planet? And with President Obama's vision to send astronauts to an asteroid, can this mission sort of be laying the groundwork for that? That's what we'll be talking about. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can tweet us a question at SciFry and also send us your comment at sciencefriday.com. Christopher Russell is principal investigator of the Dawn mission and a professor of geophysics and space physics at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Russell.
Oh, I'm pleased to be here.
It's been a long ways, hasn't it?
Oh, has it ever. And you mentioned the 4 years since launch, but we really started this project back in 1992 when they announced the possibility of investigator-led small missions to the planets. And so it's been an even longer journey for us than just those 4 years.
Wow. And why this asteroid? I know it's big, the size of Arizona. Did that have something to do with it?
Well, I guess there are some members of the team from Arizona, but that wasn't the reason. The reason is because in many senses, it's a smaller body like the moon. So it's got a basaltic surface. It's got lava flows that came out early in its existence and, you know, froze solid and been, you know, lifeless ever since. But it's very much a moon-like body, but it's about one-third of the radius of the moon. In fact, less than one-third of the radius of the moon. So it's a small a small body, but it's got many of the same processes that the moon has, and the Earth, for that matter.
And so how do you study it? What instruments, what kinds of photos, spectrographs, things like that?
Okay, well, we have a camera on board that will map the entire surface in both a clear filter and also in color filters, so we get some idea of the color in the visible. We also are measuring the infrared and looking at the reflectance of the asteroid as a function of wavelength, because there are some characteristic bands in the reflectance spectrum that enables us to determine what the minerals are on the surface. And we're also measuring the gamma rays and the neutrons from the surface that will enable us to determine the elements in the surface, as well as, especially as well as hydrogen, which will give us some idea of is there any water on the asteroid.
And next, after this asteroid, Dawn is flying to another one, Ceres. It's even bigger, right?
Yes, that's the biggest asteroid in the main belt. In fact, it's so large that it has been given the name dwarf planet. So it's in the same category as Pluto and a number of other bodies in the more distant solar system. And that's mainly because that it's so massive, although it's small, it's massive enough that it makes its surface spherical. So it's in what we call hydrostatic equilibrium, rather than the you know, an irregularly shaped rock. It's got enough mass to bring everything into a nice little tight sphere.
Well, what would you learn on Ceres that you would not learn on Dawn?
Well, Ceres is, although it was, you know, although it exists, I don't know exactly where it was made, but it was probably made in a similar region. Even though they're in similar locations, they're very, very different. And what we are interested in is trying to find out what caused that difference. Ceres is much lighter. Okay, that's the first clue, that you can measure its size fairly accurately with the Hubble Space Telescope, although we'll be able to do much better with Dawn. And you can measure its gravitational field and therefore its mass from Mars. We now know the position of our spacecraft on Mars very, very accurately, to about maybe 5 meters. And we can, when Ceres and Vesta rotate by, then they move Mars, move the spacecraft a little bit, and we can measure that, and we know, therefore, how massive it is. Huh. And so we can then solve for the density. And the density is a clue. You know, the density of water is one in our usual units. And the mass or the average density of Ceres is 2, and the average density of Vesta is about 3.5. And we therefore infer that Ceres has rock plus water, and from the density of Vesta, we infer that it has rock and iron in it. So we think that Vesta has an iron core like the Earth, but Ceres may have 100 kilometers worth of water in it, and maybe that's separated and making an ice or ice plus water ocean very deep underneath a frozen crust that's pretty dusty.
Is Ceres then a good candidate to send space probes or astronauts, as we're talking about?
Well, When we made these discoveries about the possibility of water, the first thing that NASA did was declare this as a body of astrobiological interest so that we can't do silly things there like land on it without having a disinfected spacecraft. So we didn't disinfect our spacecraft, so we're going to have to back off after we've made our serious measurements and get into an orbit that is safe so that we don't come down on the surface. So yes, it's a very important discovery, and it's a very, I would say, fairly benign place for life to exist, much better than the moons of Jupiter and Saturn.
Now, the asteroid belt is out past Mars and in between Jupiter, correct? Between Mars and Jupiter?
Right, exactly.
And there's enough rock out there? There's a lot of, you know, we see all these movies of flying through asteroid belts like they do in Star Wars and thousands and thousands of big rocks getting in your way. Is that what it looks like out there?
If you look, in the disk of it, and yes, there's going to be a lot of bodies out there. But as you're cruising around, rocks are far enough separated that the chance of running into a decent-sized rock is fairly small. And one of the things we'd like to do is, as we're moving between Vesta and Ceres, is to visit some of these other bodies that are out there. However, there's not a lot of large bodies along our trajectory, so we don't know yet whether we'll be making any neighborly stops on the way through from Vesta to Ceres.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Russell, for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you. We'll be watching.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Christopher Russell, Principal Investigator of the Dawn Mission and Professor of Geophysics and Space Physics at the University of California, Los Angeles.
The latest novel by David Ignatius, a writer for The Washington Post, begins with the head of the ISI, the Inter-Services Intelligence, the Intelligence Service of Pakistan. This fictional character, General Malik, wants to know something from the CIA, so he calls in an American intelligence agent for a conversation.
"Well then," he said, "I have a question for you. Normally I would not trouble you late in the afternoon with such a detail, but this one is rather important. I hope you will forgive the imposition and apologize to Mrs. Barkin for delaying your return home this evening. Mrs. Barkin lives in Washington, General. I don't know if I can give you an answer, but I won't tell you a lie." General Malik smiled. Americans did not like lying to others. It made them uncomfortable. Their specialty was lying to themselves.
And with that scene, David Ignatius begins the novel Blood Money. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
And the question that is on the mind of that Pakistani general is, are Americans conducting covert operations, intelligent operations on our soil without our knowledge? Which turns out to be an incredibly relevant question for right now. What got you thinking about that?
Well, when I wrote the book, I knew that there were unauthorized, undisclosed CIA operations in Pakistan. Anybody who spends any time covering this beat, as I do, finds that out. And I just began to be curious about how you'd go about conducting the operations, how you'd run them clandestinely from the United States. And the more I got thinking about these unauthorized operations, the more it seemed to me that this was a metaphor for our relationship, each of us sneaking up on the other, we not trusting the Pakistanis, they not trusting us, each, to be honest, having good reason for the mistrust. And I began to spin a story of a relationship really beginning to go out of control.
We should spell this out for people. In the novel, and apparently in real life, you have Americans slipping into Pakistan. Ordinarily, they would collaborate with the local intelligence agency because, in theory, Pakistan is an ally, but they don't know if that local intelligence agency is going to give them up. So they were simply going in quietly for their own purposes.
It's happening in the novel. In real life, you have a distinction between the declared officers who were either openly declared to the host service or easily discoverable. And then you have other people who were under much deeper cover, who typically operate with commercial platforms. And in this novel, I imagine a whole new secret wing of the CIA unable to mount clandestine operations around the world, decides to hide itself. I've invented this kind of entertainment business front in Los Angeles called the Hit Parade. in which CIA officers are hiding.
So the beginning point for this novel is something you've heard about that's rarely discussed in public. It's supposed to be covert, but it has emerged into the news again and again all year long.
Yes, we saw with the Raymond Davis case, which I have to say was eerie for me to watch because it does track elements of my book. Raymond Davis was a CIA contractor who was on the streets of Lahore, Pakistan, when he shot and killed two Pakistanis who appear to have been trailing him or in some way harassing him. And it turned out that he was part of a capability that really had not been disclosed to the Pakistanis. And as best we know, he was there as part of a surveillance and recruitment operation. So here's this real-life CIA contractor who's arrested by the Pakistanis, who it turns out is part of a whole capability not known to the American public, not known previously really to Pakistan. And at the end of the day, he's released through a payment of blood money, a sum of money which is given as a gesture of respect after the death of an adversary.
Let's talk a little more about the intelligence agency in Pakistan. You have written recently, as others have, using the phrase double game for what Pakistan is doing, working with the United States, working with militants. You've even said double game might be too simple a phrase.
Well, I think that there's some truth to that with the ISI. The ISI is always playing both sides of the fence. It's always working as the partner of the United States, and it's always pursuing its own interests as it defines them. It's always hedging its bets a little bit. I have to say, that's not really very different from the way that the United States behaves. We conduct joint operations with the ISI, but there's a lot that we don't tell them. We declare most of our personnel inside Pakistan, but there's a lot, turns out several hundred, that we don't tell them about. We reserve the right to attack our enemies using overhead predator drones, and we, as a measure of cooperation, we provide what's known as concurrent notification. Concurrent meaning after the missile has been fired and the target has been incinerated on the ground, then
meaning
we'll
we're
tell
not
you,
asking permission, we're letting you know what we're doing.
We're telling you what we just did.
Does it have to be that way?
To some extent, it does. I mean, let's be honest. Intelligence services exist to do things that are illegal abroad. They exist to tell lies. That's what Title 50 authority that the CIA has. It's the authority to conduct operations that the government will then deny ever took place.
When you think about the tortured relationship between the United States and Pakistan, as awful as it is, as angry as people end up at each other, as threatening as they sometimes are, and certainly are at this tense moment in some cases, is the relationship actually working about the way that it has to, given the difficulties of the situation?
These are two intelligence services. They're going to lie to each other. They both need each other. And I think the great challenge that I know our intelligence officers are thinking about full time is how to draw Pakistan into a process of really finding a way to bring the Taliban to the table. The Taliban is as tired of this fight as anybody. Osama bin Laden, who symbolized the need to resist, is gone. There is an open pathway. You can see it right in front of you. You just have to find it and then find a way to go down it.
The writer is David Ignatius, a newspaper columnist. His latest novel, which keeps getting overtaken by the news, is called Blood Money. David, thanks very much.
Thank
Good
you,
to see
Steve.
You.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition, edited by Greg Myrie and Chuck Holmes. The editorial staff includes Rena Advani, Shanita Anderson, Jordana Hochman, Miranda Kennedy, Mike Kennedy, Laura Krantz, and Maeve McGoran with Nina Gregory at NPR West. Our senior supervising editors are Kitty Isley and Shannon Rhodes, and our executive producer is Madalika Sicca. The Executive Director of News Programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. With Steve Inskeep, I'm Renee Montaigne.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This time, up next, something a little more swarmy. This is the time of the great reemergence, and I'm nothing to do with the end of the world. I'm talking about cicadas. From the American South up to Maryland and as far west as Iowa, periodical cicadas are making their once every 13-year appearance. In some places, they're already here, And of course, you would know that if you are in those places. In others, their presence is still yet to be felt over the next couple of weeks. And joining me now is John Cooley. He's a researcher at the University of Connecticut at Storrs. He runs the magicicada.org website, where he's tracking reports of the emergence, and he's on the road looking for cicadas. He joins us from Dixon Springs Agricultural Research Station in Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Are you actually out on the road looking for them?
Yeah, I'm actually, though, to be honest, taking a day or two off from being on the road. Since the project started, I've driven over 9,000 miles, and I'm getting a little road weary.
How do you look for them?
Well, you don't really have to look too hard. You listen, because when they're out, they make a lot of noise.
And why are these different cicadas than the kinds we hear every summer?
Well, these are periodical cicadas, and that means a couple of things. It means they come out in massive numbers. So you're talking about millions per acre. That's the figure in the literature. They also only come out as adults once every 13 or 17 years, and in the intervening years, they're just not there. And they have synchronized development. They have very characteristic appearance. They're really just not like the other cicadas.
And these are called the Brood 19 emergence, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Where do you get Brood 19 from?
Well, you know, there was a lot of work in the 19th century trying to understand these cicadas a little bit better, and there have been records of the emergences going back to the 1600s. There was a real attempt by the entomologist Charles Riley to start organizing these records. That was later picked up by Marlatt, working for the USDA later on, and they came up with a scheme for organizing the emergence records, and they decided to use Roman numerals, and they just picked an arbitrary starting point. That's Roman numeral 1. That's the brood that's coming out next year in the Blue Ridge, and it counted up to 17 from there. Those are all the 17-year cicadas. And 18 through 30 are the 13-year cicadas. Now, it turns out there are only three broods of 13-year cicadas, and that's 19, 22, and 23. But all those other slots were kind of opened on the basis that there might be broods there.
Yeah. Now, why is this one called the granddaddy of them all?
Well, I think because it really covers the largest geographic extent, and it's just not an exaggeration to say these are out from Maryland down into Georgia, over to Texas and up to Iowa. It's just an enormous area.
And so, when do they emerge, and what causes them, and what's their timing all about?
Well, the research that's been done, and you can appreciate this is a little bit difficult to study. Suggest that they're able to count the annual cycles of their host plants. So they're living underground, feeding on plant roots, and they have some way of counting those cycles. We don't really know how. Then they get to the right year that way, and in the right year, they're monitoring soil temperature. And the figure that you see in the literature is they're waiting for the temperature to get to be about 62 degrees Fahrenheit, and then the nymphs come out of the ground and molt to the adults, and the emergence is on.
And you're out there in Illinois where they're emerging.
Yeah, you know, we're really not at the peak yet because the weather has been a little bit off, I have to say. It's been kind of cool and rainy.
It has been wacky weather.
All you out here, yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And so would they be emerging in the south then where it's a little warmer?
Oh, yes, they're full-blown out in some places in the south. We were in Nashville a couple of days ago, and there are some good choruses going there, certainly down Montgomery, Alabama. Meridian, Mississippi, all those places have good choruses going. And we have the nymphs just starting to get going up here in Illinois.
And how long do they live for so that we can know when the symphony is over?
Well, of course, the simple answer to that is 13 years. But as adults, they last on the order of, I'd have to say, 4-ish weeks. A month is a good rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm. Why would an animal choose to sit out for 13 or 17 years? What is the advantage of staying away so long?
Well, you know, that really is kind of the key question, and I have to be honest with you, we don't have any simple answers to it. We suspect that if we do ever find out the answer to that, it's going to be related to the unusual biology of these cicadas. They rely on massive numbers to avoid being eaten by predators. It's kind of like an insurance policy. We call it predator satiation, but what it really means is the individual risk to a cicada is zero because there are so many of them. The predators can go there and eat all they want, and the risk is still zero to any individual cicada. So they're coming out periodically to accomplish that, these mass emergences. The long life cycle, that's a little bit harder to figure out. To be honest, we don't know the life cycles of many cicadas. Perhaps they're all long.
Hmm.
The interesting thing about 13 and 17 is their primes. And I have some colleagues working on some papers, some mathematical models to figure out whether these prime-numbered life cycles really lend themselves to having these mass periodical emergences with no adults out in between.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
that's the key to the thing.
That is interesting. And you are sort of crowdsourcing the sightings. Are you not? You're looking for people, if they see the emergence, to let you know.
Yeah, we're definitely encouraging people to report sightings on the website because, to be honest, we're working on maps that are very old. They're from the 19th century.
They're made out of paper.
Well, yeah, they are. Now it's all electrons.
Right.
We'd like to update those. A lot of the questions about periodical cicadas have to do with whether the edges of broods or species are moving, and we can't tell that from the old maps.
And so if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, they'll have a link to your website, and people can report in when they hear the emergence. Will they know the difference between their ordinary cicadas and these when they hear them?
Yeah, there are pictures on the website. It's kind of a radio button thing where you see a picture and you click under it. And you'll know it because of the numbers. For those of you who haven't been through one of these emergences, I guess you're in for a treat, but you certainly are in for something unlike anything you've seen before.
Let's go to Steve back in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hi, Steve.
Hi. My question was simply, how do they possibly make that much noise? I mean, I know it's the numbers in this particular case, but I've heard individuals, you know, like outside in my tree, and it's quite a noise.
What explanation? Got a good question. Thanks for calling. What is that explanation?
Well, only the males are making the noise, so you're only hearing half the population.
Isn't that true of everything?
Yeah, just about, I think. They have a pair of special organs on the first abdominal segment called timbals. Looks like a little potato chip. If you pick one up and bend the wing back, you're going to see it there. It's a little white membrane, and that's the noisemaker.
Mm.
And the abdomen is a hollow resonator, and the sound radiates out through two openings on the bottom. The funny thing is, these cicadas individually really aren't that loud. It's the aggregate numbers that get the sound up in these choruses.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sharon in Philly. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I actually have a statement first. When I was a kid, that song by Glen Campbell, The Wichita Lineman, you know, the sound comes through. The Wichita Lineman is still in the line. It's something about the sound coming through the wires. And I was very young, okay? But I would hear cicadas, and I thought, oh, that must be the sound from the lineman coming, you know, through the wires. And I thought, oh, my goodness, when I really found out what the sound came from. But anyway, the reason I was calling is killer wasps. We found them a couple years ago after moving to an old farmhouse. And I found out that it were called killer wasps, but I didn't know, you know, who they attacked or why they were called killer. But apparently they attack cicadas or eat them. Are they like a primary source of,
food source.
You know, is the cicada their primary source, or is that, you know, a primary predator for the cicada?
Sure. Cicada killer wasps are, again, fascinating insects. They do specialize on cicadas. They will take periodical cicadas. They're also very good predators of our summer cicadas, our dog day cicadas. And the wasps, the female wasp, will capture a cicada, drag it down into her burrow, and just about like something in a horror movie, lay her eggs on it. The eggs hatch, and the cicada is sitting there paralyzed but still alive, and the larvae eat their way through it. It really is the stuff of horror movies. That said, you know, with the periodical cicadas, there just aren't enough wasps to really make a big dent in the population.
Mm-hmm. Just to reiterate, though, these are not these flying locusts that people confuse, what, every 17 years or something like that.
Yeah, you know, that's funny, too. These are not locusts. Locusts are grasshoppers, but the name got stuck onto them because the Puritan colonists in Massachusetts in the 1600s witnessed a periodical cicada emergence and pretty much thought the end of the world was coming.
Wow. So we here in New York, we have yet to hear them, or are they out? They're not out yet.
Well, in New York State, certainly the areas around New York City, you're in Brood 2 territory. That's 17-year cicadas, and you'll be seeing them in about 2012.
Oh, something to look forward to. And where will your travels take you next?
Next? Well, I need to get down to Arkansas and have a look there. And 13 years ago, my colleagues and I discovered a new species down there, and we're going to go see what it's been up to. It actually happens also to be at this spot in Dixon Springs. I caught a few of them this morning.
And what would you like to know most about them? You seem to say that we really don't know that much about the cicada.
Well, you know, I think in anything that we do in science, we always raise more questions than we answer. But if I had a time-lapse movie of what these cicadas did during the past couple of glacial cycles, that would make me happy, because the species are old, but the territory they live in is not. It was all glaciated or affected by glaciers. I'd like to know where they spent the last, 25,000-30,000 years.
Is there any way to find that out?
Well, there are various ways to get at that peripherally by looking at the genetic structure of the populations and by looking at the distributions. We're also doing some ecological modeling of the distributions, but a time-lapse movie would make it simple.
Wow, that would be cool. Can you see a time-lapse movie of a cicada emerging anywhere?
Well, yes, actually, people like to shoot that. I know that there was a sequence of that in a BBC series a couple of years ago, and someone is coming out Monday to shoot a time-lapse of a cicada coming out of the ground.
All right. Well, sounds like you have an exciting week ahead of you.
And a lot of people have an exciting month ahead of them, too.
Well, we're looking forward to it. Thank you for taking time to be with us, and happy cicada hunting. May you be very successful.
Oh, thank you very much.
John Cooley is a researcher at the University of Connecticut at Storrs, and he's finding out more about insects. And you can report, if you see the cicadas, you can report the cicadas to magicicada.org. Our website also has a link.